You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 28th, 2013 from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Persephone and I discuss the civil war in Syria, American drone strikes on U.S. civilians, the U.S. job market, and President Obama's new comments on the Keystone XL pipeline. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey, your host. Joining me as usual is co-host Persephone. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't we talk first about the situation in Syria, since last week's episode was largely focused on U.S. domestic politics. The situation in Syria continues to become worse and worse as every week passes. The latest reports is that the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is a group sympathetic to the opposition, has reported that the opposition side, rebels from some of the Islamist groups linked with Al-Qaeda, according to this New York Times article on their report, they said that that group killed 150 soldiers in a suburb of Aleppo, 150 government soldiers, including 51 who were executed after they had surrendered. There are photos of them having lined up 50 troops against the wall and shot them while they were unarmed and had surrendered. So there seems to have been a pretty significant mass execution reported. There were also other reports of Syria. That I should stress was from a pretty credible group that is aligned with the opposition and is reporting that the opposition conducted these crimes, which to me sounds more credible than say if it's coming from the government. But the government also reported more recently that insurgents had killed 123 people, majority civilian, during an offensive on the town of Khan al-Assad, according to Reuters. And this is coming as the death toll in the war comes to over 100,000. And of course, there is, as we've talked about previously on the show, this division between the various different factions, that there's Syrian regime troops, there's Hezbollah lined up with the regime, there's Alawite militias lined up with the regime, there's secular Sunni Arab rebels, there's Islamist Sunni Arab rebels, etc. There's also been reports of about 30 more people who were executed by by one of these Islamist groups, according to the regime. And there were actually videos posted by one of these groups that had done the executions. They executed 30 young men, according to this Reuters article, and claimed that they were pro-Assad militiamen. So these would be the Alawite militia troops, which, as I talked about on a previous episode of the show, their motivation is basically that if the Alawite Shia regime falls, they will all be targeted. Their fear is, at least, that they will all be targeted in reprisals for many of the crimes perpetrated by the Assad Alawite government against the Arab population and the Sunni Arab population in the rest of the country. There were also reports that the government, well, I assume it's the government who has the missiles, has been killing large numbers of civilians in surface-to-surface missile attacks, which means that that's pretty self-explanatory, but it means they're firing a missile from one point to another point, and then it's landing and killing a lot of people, as opposed to being a rocket, which is a smaller device, or something that was not intended as a surface-to-surface thing. So I think that's potentially a significant development. There were also reports in the same Reuters piece that ethnically Kurdish rebel troops in Turkey, these are probably PKK troops who have long clashed with the Turkish government in their struggle for independence, that they ended up getting into a border skirmish along the Turkish-Syrian border with some of these Islamist Sunni groups in Syria. And that's a situation I would say probably a good idea to keep an eye on, as the Arab population has committed a lot of crimes against the Kurds in the past, and maybe the Kurds would be motivated to get involved in some way, although they aren't sympathetic to either the Sunni Arab Islamists or the Shia Alawite groups linked with the regime. Persephone, did you have any comments on this situation, some of these crimes that have occurred as the death toll has crossed 100,000?
Well, unfortunately, it seems to be, I mean, this is something that we even mentioned earlier a few episodes back, is that it's a little predictable, unfortunately, that there are going to be a lot of civilian casualties and on both sides, but, you know, including on the opposition side, and it's pretty discouraging, but unfortunately just sort of how the course of this has been progressing.
Have you been reassessing at all your thoughts on, we had had a disagreement on kind of how to approach this situation, and I was in the camp of this has to kind of work itself out on its own because any intervention is going to make the situation worse, not better, and your position was that kind of we have to do something, whether it's some sort of intervention or just a peaceful negotiation strategy. And everyone seems to be, the negotiators seem to be kind of skeptical that anything's going to come out of any of this. But as one of them said, we have to do something because doing nothing is not an acceptable option. I mean, so have you thought about your position on this anymore or what that might look like?
Well, I have been thinking it over, and I do think that with all that's going on, it might, you know, I feel like a line has been crossed, a sort of point of no return, where it's going to be very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to prevent this violence. But I still do feel that not to make the attempt is in some ways risky. I still think that, you know, pretty idealist, but that there is an ethical obligation to do what can be done to encourage negotiation rather than bloodshed.
Right. And I think some observers are saying that maybe there's some sort of window for opportunity here to negotiate if the Islamist groups continue to grow in strength, because the non-Islamist rebel groups are probably about as concerned about them as they are about the regime. And the regime is certainly concerned. And if they can find common ground on that point of disagreement, maybe they can work something out. Come to some agreement. But I question kind of the durability of something like that, because it seems like once they eliminated that problem, then the other problem would come right back again. And there's also, you know, I think once you open that Pandora's box of ethnic cleansing operations, which has been what's happening, I mean, eventually with time and peacekeeping force standing physically in between two groups, you can get that situation to calm down somewhat. But, you know, it does take a very long time, usually generations. Maybe it can be sped up a little bit with some sort of truth and reconciliation process, but usually I think that doesn't even work that well necessarily. And it's better than not doing it probably, but it's going to take quite a few generations for that memory to fade. And we know that culturally the memories are go back pretty far in the Middle East, that these, you know, this erupting Shia and Sunni split that was kind of reopened by the Iraq War, unleashed by that, and continues to widen there, that dates back to something that happened in the, you know, the 700s. You know, that was a really, really long time ago, and they haven't given up on that point yet. So the idea that they're just gonna forgive and forget and shake hands and move on because they have this common enemy or something, I think that seems to me to be pretty preposterous.
Well, I don't think that memories are actually that long. I think that's what is happening is that people are digging up these old stories and these old elements of history when it works in their interest. I think that it is possible for them to forget, but I think it just depends on what's in their interests.
That's a fair point. I think obviously it continues to be an evolving situation there. But and certainly one for concern. And we'll keep an eye on it. And you know, if there are more developments, we'll talk more about those. But I still kind of think that there's not a lot that can realistically be done in this situation.
I'm inclined to agree that not a lot can be done, but I'm still not sure about whether something should be attempted.
Right. Let's turn now to American foreign policy. There was an op-ed a couple weeks ago by Nasser al-Awlaki, and it was titled "The Drone That Killed My Grandson." He's talking about his 16-year-old grandson, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki. His 16-year-old grandson was killed in Yemen. He was a United States citizen, as was his more famous father, Anwar al-Awlaki. And whether or not people agree with how Awlaki's elimination was taken care of, and I happen to disagree with how it was handled, most people generally agree that Anwar al-Awlaki was a pretty bad guy, that he was not a very savory character. I don't think that he should have been executed by a drone strike as an American citizen. I mean, that seems unconstitutional to me and pretty horrible. And he was kind of trying to inspire terrorist attacks and recruit people to join terrorist efforts in Yemen, but he himself was not necessarily committing these attacks. So the idea that he was executed by a drone as an American citizen without any kind of trial or anything, that is, I disagree with that. But as I said, whether people think it was a good idea to do that or not, most people agree that he was a fairly unsavory character and, you know, sort of wannabe bin Laden type, but certainly on a lower scale. However, his son, Abdul Rahman, born and raised in the United States, was 16 years old, did not go to Yemen with his father, actually went separately to try to track down his father, who had kind of vanished out of the picture, and he was trying to figure out what had happened to him and why he had gone off to be this terrorist mastermind type guy or mini mastermind in Yemen, this leader within Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And he went to Yemen, was not involved in any terrorist activities as far as we know. Even the United States government seems to have confirmed at this point that they don't think that this kid was involved. I don't think he even ended up meeting up with his father. And just all of a sudden one day while he was sitting at a cafe, the cafe was blown up by an American drone strike and he was killed along with a bunch of other people. The United States government saying this was an accident. I find that extremely hard to believe, that they just happened to kill the son of this other guy that they had also already killed in a drone strike. And they're saying, oh, it was an accident. We were trying to target someone else, but they refused to say who they were targeting. And this, you know, killed a lot of other people too. But the grandfather of Abdul Rahman is now trying to sue to get more information and to basically say that this was, you know, an unjust act and that the government needs to kind of compensate the family, I think, and make recompense for this effectively murder of someone who wasn't involved in terrorist activities and was a U.S. citizen and was killed without any kind of trial or anything. And the fact that apparently because he was the right age and was the son of a known terrorist, and he was in the wrong country, that this automatically made him a terrorist as well. But the U.S. government now saying that there wasn't evidence to suggest that, or that they certainly don't have any now. There was also a related article involved in this case. A U.S. judge saying that, because the government was basically trying to say that the U.S. judiciary system had no jurisdiction to make rulings one way or the other in a case involving U.S. drone strikes overseas, particularly against U.S. citizens or anything. They had a legal process that was overseen by Congress, came out of the executive branch. The executive branch got to make decisions on these things. And then the judiciary didn't have any say because it happened outside the country. This judge, Rosemary Collier, in the U.S. District Court, asked, are you saying that a U.S. citizen targeted by the United States in a foreign country has no constitutional rights? How broadly are you asserting the right of the United States to target an American citizen? Where is the limit to this? The limit is the courthouse door. According to the New York Times report on this case that they published on July 19th. you know, certainly the bulk of the attention on this has been taken up by people like Rand Paul, who I'd prefer not to be giving any attention to. This is something that, you know, people like me have been complaining about now for quite a few years, and saying that this was well before Alaki, the father, was killed by a drone strike. There was a significant run-up in this period before that for quite a few months, if not an entire year. I forget the exact timeline at this point, of basically leaks that said that the U.S. government was, within the executive branch at least, was coming up with an official legal justification and explanation for how to do this. They had this complex thing where if they couldn't put an American citizen on a targeted kill list, but they could put someone else who was also sitting there, you know, in the same target site on the list. So if they targeted a non-American citizen who was standing right next to an American citizen, then it was an acceptable collateral damage that the American citizen they actually wanted to target was killed. This was known well in advance of his assassination that they were working out this so-called protocol to be able to do this, but there was no judicial oversight to this, and there continues to not be judicial oversight. And they, the U.S. government trying to argue that the courts don't have the apparatus to analyze this. This was the official argument made in this latest case. And the judge said, no, the executive is not an effective check on the executive itself. And she said, you'd be surprised at the amount of understanding that other parts of the government think judges have. So other parts of the government regularly leave judges to work out very complex cases involving things like, you know, patent laws or, you know, drug approvals, or there's intelligence courts and things like that, that there's, you know, that there's all kinds of complicated legal things that come before the judiciary. In fact, the pretty much any time that a government agency is involved in a lawsuit, it could be something involving some complex, you know, environmental regulation on a pollutant. All that goes through the court system in Washington, D.C., and so on and so forth. So she's saying this is absurd to say that the courts don't have the knowledge or logic to be able to figure out how they should appropriately rule in a drone case, especially one involving an American citizen. And, you know, in the past, there have been, you know, the policy has generally been you got to bring back these people alive. They didn't even make any attempt to do this in the case in Yemen. But again, this case, less about the fact that they assassinated Alaki, who everyone acknowledges was a terrorist, and more about the fact that they assassinated his son in a separate attack. Abdul Rahman, a 16-year-old who was not involved in terrorism, blew up an entire cafe, killing a lot of other random civilians in Yemen as well. I mean, where does this end? And, you know, I hate to be the people, you know, I don't want to be that, like, crazy conspiracy theorist libertarian who's like saying that this is imminently going to happen within the United States or whatever, but like, you do have to start to wonder when they start coming up with these complex rationales to be able to justify assassinating Americans with armed drones overseas, of saying, you know, what about in the United States? And then you get the people, oh, well, you don't have anything to hide, then what do you have to fear? It's like, but the United States has a long, long history of targeting people at various levels of government, whether at the local level, all the way up to the federal government, of targeting people who haven't in fact done anything and are somehow accidentally or intentionally blamed or framed for things. And that's not a conspiracy theory. We have lots of examples of these cases where people have been kind of framed for things, or accidentally suspected of things. And what if they start, you know, to suspect the wrong people? One example you can think of is how the local law enforcement and members of the media thought that in the Olympic Centennial Stadium bombing in 1996, they thought that the guy who was saving everyone's lives because he noticed this backpack that ended up having a bomb in it and started moving people out of the way, so he kept the death toll a lot lower. People thought that he must have done it, you know, he must have planted the bomb, and that ruined his life, even though he was subsequently cleared and they much later found the guy who actually did it. But they didn't immediately find that guy, and so there was always this kind of suspicion. And, you know, what if that security guard guy or police officer had panicked and tried to run or something, and then the government had said, oh, well, he must have been the guy who did it, and, you know, that sort of thing. Or you can look at situations with local police departments that have, you know, records of framing people for various crimes, murders, planting evidence at the scene, that sort of thing. You know, what about, you know, we know O.J. Simpson actually pretty much did commit murders, but he ended up getting acquitted because the police, somebody, some overzealous detective or something had tried to plant a glove at the scene, and it ended up not fitting, and thus the famous line about that. But, you know, we know that local and state and federal government in the past has framed people, and now we know that they have assassinated, including accidentally, assassinated American citizens overseas with drones. So when these, you know, libertarian guys start freaking out about that, I think you do have to start to wonder, is this something that's going to start happening in the United States? Maybe not in the immediate future, but we also have started seeing reports that the FBI, for example, has used surveillance drones a number of times in recent years. I think that's something that's coming up under Supreme Court privacy cases recently about what constitutes, you know, where do you need a warrant, what constitutes reasonable suspicion to, you know, send up a helicopter or a drone to go look at someone's greenhouse or something for marijuana, things like that. You know, I don't think that it's that huge of a leap that eventually, if there's a domestic terrorist or suspected domestic terrorist, that we could start seeing this being applied within the United States. Now, I guess they would say, well, there's different laws in the United States and different laws overseas. But the question is that really the way that it should work? And I think that this court case is going to raise some very important questions about what the limits of this are and who oversees it, because it just has such a weak oversight system.
I think that the idea that the court system would not have jurisdiction is a little bit ridiculous, but if the government wants to go there and they want to say that the federal courts can't handle this, then I would have to ask, well, in that case, there are other court systems, you know? Does the United States government really want to end up with major figures at the International Court of Justice for targeting civilians? I mean, I don't think that that's where they want to go. So their best bet is to keep things in the federal system and to treat United States citizens with the rights that they deserve and that they have under the Constitution. And I think that, you know, whatever else you want to say about the judiciary, they are the ones who know the Constitution. You know, sometimes, yes, the Supreme Court has manipulated the Constitution, but they are the ones that know the Constitution and understand the Constitution to an extent that I think even a lot of legislators do not.
Right. And I don't understand the rationale behind this kind of claim that White House legal counsel office has more constitutional experience and national security knowledge than a member of the court in Washington, D.C. Like, I don't understand where that assumption would come from or be drawn from. It seems like a weird claim to make and kind of a stretch.
Well, I think the claim is being made that really what they're saying isn't even that the court doesn't understand law, but really that they don't understand security, and that security, you can do anything for security, and if you're doing something in the interest of the United States and the security of the United States, then you're above the law. I think that's what it comes down to, and I think that is really a complete misunderstanding of everything that our country is founded on. Not to use a cliche, but there you go. I mean, this is not, these kinds of security measures completely overlook, you know, rights. And that is a threat to security. Overlooking the rights of citizens is a threat to the security of U.S. citizens.
By taking up arms against the United States and leaving the country, you don't forfeit all of your rights or your citizenship. I mean, that's a preposterous argument to make. Whether or not you like their actions doesn't mean that they've lost their citizenship or their rights. And the U.S. government charged with both protecting its citizens and bringing citizens to justice under the legal system that we've set up to deal with that, and, you know, the Bill of Rights that we established to help deal with that, you know, that U.S. citizens are guaranteed a trial, etc. And it's not like, you know, it's not like this was a manhunt on foot that led to a police shootout and then somebody died and now you can't charge them. I mean, this was just a one-sided from the sky, all of a sudden a missile, boom, the end. There was no attempt made to bring him in alive or anything like that to stand trial. And again, I can't stress this enough. Pre-9/11, we consistently brought people to U.S. courts to be tried, or we tried them in absentia or things like that. We brought these people through, you know, and they weren't even U.S. citizens. And we brought them through the U.S. court system because that was what the Reagan administration said when terrorism was really spiking in the 70s and then, you know, somewhat in the 80s. The Ronald Reagan administration said, hey, the way to deal with terrorism is to treat them like the criminals that they are and pursue them by normal anti-criminal means. They're not supervillains. You treat them through the normal court system as the criminals that they are. You de-glorify them and you bring them to justice because that's what a nation with the rule of law does. They have a legal system and they follow the legal system and they go through the various procedures and they bring someone to justice. When did we get back to this point where we're just going to be launching these sky attacks and saying that is justice? You know, and that, you know, it's controversial that they did the raid on bin Laden and shot him in that as opposed to bringing him back alive. That was probably a pretty big logistical concern about whether or not they were going to be able to bring him back alive successfully. But, you know, questions there as well. But this is a case where they made no effort to recover a U.S. citizen and bring him to any kind of trial. They just blew him off the face of the earth and then, for whatever reason, decided to do the same for his son, who was in a different place at a different time, had no terrorist connections, and was just trying to find out why his dad left the United States suddenly to become a terrorist mastermind.
And I think that you brought up another good point, which is that when you do this kind of thing, you're creating martyrs. You're creating, first of all, there's no way to target every single individual in these countries who has any anti-US sentiment. At that point, you might as well just nuke the place because you're not going to be able to target every single person. And so what's going to happen with these drone attacks, they're not an effective threat because the people that are most afraid of them are civilians. The people that are actual threats, they are going to find a way to hide. They have these advanced networks.
Or they've already made the decision that they're willing to die. I mean, it's kind of like, it reminds me of the argument about, you know, minimum mandatories and death penalties for drug kingpins and stuff in the United States, and people saying, how does that make sense to be applying these stringent penalties to drug dealers and drug kingpins, thinking that that is somehow going to make them so scared that they'll stop what they're doing when they've already effectively, you know, lived this lifestyle where they could be killed capriciously at any moment. You know, and this is a similar case where they're in combat roles. They've made the decision that they're willing to die for a cause. You're terrifying the civilians who haven't wanted to be involved in this, but you're not, you know, threatening or deterring these other people. There's nobody who's going to say, oh, well, I was thinking of becoming a terrorist, but then I was afraid of getting blown up by a drone. Because you could get blown up by a drone even if you didn't become a terrorist and you didn't do anything. So, you know, what's the incentive there? And you can't just kill, as you said, you can't just kill everyone that you suspect of being involved in something like this. It doesn't work like that, and it's not going to work as a strategy, and could arguably backfire and create more of these extremists and worsen the problem. This is not an effective deterrent. And, you know, I'm reminded of lines also with the, you know, regard to the death penalty, as like society and civilization. Of course, a lot of Americans don't agree with this, but as an advanced civilized society, we shouldn't be taking away people's lives or going outside the legal system at minimum. If you support the death penalty, that there should be a procedure that gets followed and that you go through these various steps, you hold a trial and you convict people and then you sentence them accordingly and appropriately, that you don't have, you know, that you don't go and say, well, you murdered my family member, so now I'm just going to go rogue and just kill someone. You know, if a, if a, if a police officer's family member was killed and then he went rogue and killed someone, he would probably face charges for doing that. And you might sympathize with him, but that's not what you do in a civilized society. There's a procedure. You bring people in, you convict, you try them and you convict them, and then you sentence them accordingly. This is it seems to me like a significant walk back in our development as a civilized society, that we're now just going to capriciously and arbitrarily blow people up from above and cause a lot of collateral damage at the same time.
I think that also one thing that we are going to see as these situations progress and as we get more and more trials related to them and court cases and suits, I think we're going to see arguments that people who engage in terrorist activities or who support terrorism verbally or in other ways, we're going to see the federal government arguing that these people have effectively renounced their U.S. citizenship as a way to target them more. And I think that's something that's very dangerous, and it's something that that people should keep an eye on, because that can eventually, you know, lead to anybody who expresses any dissatisfaction with the government becoming a target.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here on Arsenal for Democracy and be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, here with Persephone. We're going to talk now about the U.S. economy. There, on July 26th, Gallup released its unemployment figures, which is a little bit different than the U.S. government's unemployment figures. They actually go over in this article their differences. So for one thing, they're sampling 18 years and older as opposed to 16 years and older. They're not doing seasonal adjustments the way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does. They survey about half as many households per month. They have a different style of interviewing and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they do more frequent data collection with 30-day averages instead of one-week reference periods at the end of each month. So there are some differences, so it can't necessarily compare it directly to Bureau of Labor Statistics. But it is interesting to see the trends within their own sampling, which is always the thing you want to look for in polls that have done repeat polling. So let's talk a little bit about their findings. The big top line headline here, younger Americans less likely to have full-time work now regardless of education than a year ago. So they said currently Americans aged 18 to 29 who have at least a college degree are nearly twice as likely, 65.4%, as their counterparts without a degree, 38.6%, to have a full-time job. And, you know, so there is still a benefit to having a college degree, you know, right now, but they're saying that either way, there are fewer young adults with a college degree who now hold a full-time job compared to June 2012, a little over a year ago, and the same with people without. So with or without a college degree, a smaller proportion of young Americans age 18 to 29 hold jobs, full-time jobs now than they did a year ago. Now, I suspect that there's importance here, full-time job being a key operative word versus some employment, because the U.S., and this is a reason to look at the Gallup data versus the U.S. data, the U.S. measures the official unemployment rate in terms of whether you have a paying job of some kind that you're reporting income for. If you are working 5 hours a week, you know, clearly not a full-time job by any stretch of the imagination, that counts as being employed. There are some other, like U6 unemployment indicators, which is a more expanded definition that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has, where they're measuring underemployment as well, but that's not the one that gets most of the media attention. So what you usually hear about is just the U3 standard unemployment rate. That means if you have some kind of paying job, that counts as being employed. Gallup here is saying full-time jobs. So some of these folks might have part-time jobs. We've talked about this a few weeks ago on the show about the rise of part-time jobs and some of the problems that come with that. But they're saying that compared to a year ago, the proportion of 18 to 29 year olds with or without a college degree is actually lower now than it was a year ago, and for full-time employment. The other headline that I wanted to highlight from this is that it says older Americans are more likely to hold full-time jobs now than a year ago. And, you know, for 30 to 49 year olds, it's about the same. For 50 to 64 year olds, it's risen slightly by a couple percentage points over a year. And for 65 or older, it has risen by a little over a percentage point in terms of that population that is working full time. And I think that these are interrelated problems: the youth underemployment and unemployment, and the rising employment percentage of these 50 to 64 year olds and 65 or older folks. That effectively means that these older populations are waiting longer to retire, either by choice or by necessity. In a lot of cases, probably by necessity, because their retirement plans have been thrown out of whack by the recession and slow recovery. And that means that because they are not retiring, they're effectively occupying spaces that would have been filled in a lot of cases by the new crop, or some of the new crop of graduates from college each year. This is becoming a very serious problem. We did an entire episode at one point about some of these problems. The fact that there's not this good turnover, you gotta each year have a certain number of older workers retiring to make room for younger workers, or else you start running into serious problems. That also starts affecting things like the Social Security finances, because there aren't these newer workers paying in. There's just these older workers who are about to be retiring anyway and pulling money out of the system and collecting almost immediately. And I think it is interesting as well that 50 to 64 year olds, now at this point, less than half of the adult population that age is employed full time, which I don't know what it typically is. I guess, you know, it's been pretty low for a while, but that seems like an interesting finding to me. But that's actually is creeping back up compared to last year, the year before that, and 2010. And you know, at least the 30 to 49 year olds, that's stable, and stable is probably a good direction. But we would probably want the older population to start going down, especially for the 65 years and older. We don't want to see that number going back up. We want to see that going down due to retirement, because we want people to be retiring to open up spots for these younger workers. So those were the two key headlines there. Persephone, I wanted to get your commentary on these two findings.
Well, I think it's just another demonstration of where things are headed, and people having to work past the retirement age is really, it's bad for the economy. It's bad for everybody, and it's especially bad for those people, because it means that Social Security is not sufficient. It means that they're not getting enough, or they haven't gotten enough from their jobs. And they are, I think it's also reflective of people are now aware that they're going to be living in into their 90s and possibly even to be 100, and they need to keep that money going as long as possible. And so they need to stay employed, you know, well into their senior years. And I don't think that's a very healthy way to run a society. I think that it's a problem for young people, and it's a problem for old people.
Right. And also to build on that, I think that we've got to remind everyone the implications of long-term youth unemployment is that for every year that someone has been out of college but not employed, that becomes a serious drag on their ability to get hired in the future and to earn income. It actually affects their lifetime earning potential. You can think a lot similarly about, say, you know, this issue comes up as well with women who leave the workforce for a number of years to have children and raise those children and then come back later, because they sometimes find that employers are skeptical that they're still, you know, ready to go, ready to be part of the workforce, that they have the relevant experience because they've been out of the game for a certain number of years. These younger folks who are graduating from college don't even have the opportunity to get in the game in the first place. every year that becomes more and more of a challenge because you've got this choice between, oh, well, I could hire someone who's been unemployed for 3 years, graduated 3 years ago, or I can hire someone who's just gotten out of college now and is fully on top of their game, hasn't been, you know, lingering in unemployment and out of the, you know, usual habits of work, supposedly. I question in reality whether or not some of that's true, but that's at least how employers look at it in a lot of cases. So the longer these people are not able to find their first job is going to have a really serious ripple effect down the line. And with the numbers we're seeing, that's less of an individual case-by-case problem and more of a pretty big societal wave coming that's going to be a big problem down the line.
I think we are looking at a lost generation. I think we're looking at everybody who graduated during this recession and who had trouble finding work, everyone who graduated without, some people without even having worked a job in high school or in college because those jobs just weren't available, especially in more rural areas, those people are not going to be able to find work. And as soon as things start to get better, everybody who's graduating then is going to take the jobs, and we're going to just have a lot of people in poverty or in poor economic conditions because of the luck of the draw and the luck of when they graduated.
And of course, they're going to continue to be crippled by student debt, as we've also talked about previously on Arsenal for Democracy, because student debt was reformed in the mid-2000s to be one of the few things that you had to start paying immediately regardless of your job. You can, if you have a job, you can sometimes get the payments adjusted according to your income level, but you have to start making payments within 6 months whether or not you have a job, and you cannot go bankrupt on it. And unlike every other kind of debt, you cannot go bankrupt on your student loan debt. So we've now gotten over $1 trillion in outstanding student loan debt borne by the U.S. population, and I mean, I don't know what the end game is. I don't know how you get $1 trillion back out of these people in any orderly fashion that actually gets it paid off without ruining a lot of people completely, which is already probably starting to happen, and you're not letting any of them walk away from it at all. And again, it's not like they're deadbeats who just can't be bothered to pay or something. In a lot of cases, they do not have the income to pay off this debt. So, you know, I do not know what the plan there is. We need to see some pretty serious changes coming there, or we're just going to start seeing some pretty serious problems down the line that are just going to be kind of disasters that we don't even have an idea of where to begin on how to fix.
I also want to comment on, you know, a lot of the arguments that have been made to sort of attack people who graduate with a great amount of debt and can't repay it is, oh, you know, they should have majored in something more practical. They should have majored in something, you know, that will directly lead to a job. I see this argument a lot, and I think it's important to look at, first of all, the reality that even some of the, you know, supposedly more practical jobs, I mean, STEM, for instance, STEM fields are getting a ton of grant funding and things like that. And a lot of colleges really push those. But even for people that want to be employed in those sectors, it can often be very difficult to find work and to get research because the government doesn't want to fund general research. It wants to fund things related to defense. It wants to fund certain kinds of, for instance, biopharmaceuticals are looking to employ graduates. There's no investment in the more general research.
They just want applied research that goes, you know, is going to have returns for the government's investment.
Which in the long term is really a dangerous thing, because if we don't have that basic research to build off of, then it's going to hurt our more applied science too. And, you know, as for the humanities, I think that part of the reason that it's harder to employ humanities graduates is that our society has been moving away from any sort of leisure time. And it's, you know, people are expected to work and spend all day at these, you know, and now we're seeing it at these part-time jobs. You're going from, you know, if you're working at a restaurant and then you go and work as a sales clerk, you're not going to have any time to do anything that enriches your life.
All right. Well, let's turn now to the Keystone XL pipeline. A few weeks ago on the show, we talked about President Obama's big climate speech that didn't get a lot of attention because it was the same week as the Supreme Court decisions on the Defense of Marriage Act, Proposition 8, and the Voting Rights Act. Most of that was getting the bulk of the attention, and then President Obama went to Africa immediately after the speech. And one thing that we focused on was this very kind of minor passing reference to this idea that the Keystone XL pipeline that has to be approved by the State Department to cross the border from Canada into the United States, and we've talked about this a lot of times on the show, President Obama saying that the pollution factor, or how much this project would increase pollution, was gonna be a determining factor in whether or not his State Department and his administration would approve this pipeline to go forward. And that marked a pretty big shift, but it was, as I think we said then, we were going to have to wait and see how this actually played out and what else developed from there. What we've seen now, according to an article, a New York Times article by Michael D. Shear and Jackie Combs in the New York Times on July 27th, is that President Obama gave an interview where he elaborated on this point and said that he would, quote, evaluate the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline on the basis of whether it would significantly contribute carbon to the atmosphere. The article goes on to say that President Obama, and I think this is a huge shift, was openly criticizing, they referred to it as mocking, but I don't know if that's a fair characterization tonally, that he was criticizing Republicans' arguments about the pipeline being a job creator. This is something we've talked about numerous times on the show, and he actually seemed to be citing a lot of the same stuff we've said, which is that this is not a job creation project. At most, it creates 2,000 jobs temporarily for about a year or two through the construction process. But in fact, there's some evidence that it is even lower than 2,000 because it's really basically like a short-term job in one county, and then you get those same 10 or 15 people to move to the next county and build the next section of the pipeline. And that, you know, those 15 people now count as 30 jobs because they worked them in two different places and they were short-term jobs. And so on and so forth. But at most, 2,000 jobs during the construction period that would take a year or two. And then he said, and then after that, we're talking about somewhere between 50 and 100 jobs permanently, basically, in an economy of 150 million working people. And he referred to this as a blip relative to the need. So this would be a huge pipeline with all kinds of ramifications, would not create that many jobs. It would at most create 2,000 temporary jobs that don't anywhere near justify doing this project on economic and job creation grounds. Yes, the need for jobs is critical in this economy. This is not the way to be doing it. There are so many other infrastructure projects that the Republicans who are so enthusiastic about this Keystone XL infrastructure pipeline project refuse to put any money into. You know, just all kinds of roads and bridges that are collapsing, falling apart, disintegrating, going back to being gravel roads in some places, which is like the reversal of the pinnacle of American civilization.
The trains.
The trains could certainly use a lot of overhauls. We have Republican governors and such vetoing and rejecting funding for high-speed rail that's already been approved and that sort of thing. A lot of times without even needing any extra funding from the from their own state governments. They just, like with the Medicaid programs that I talked about last week on the show with Sarah, that these state governments are rejecting these freebies just out of spite, essentially. And if they wanted to create jobs, even temporary ones, but in large numbers, think about all the massive infrastructure projects they could work on that would create huge jobs and have rippling multiplier effects throughout the economy. So I think that it is critical to see President Obama starting to what I believe is laying the rhetorical groundwork and kind of the political arguments against this pipeline in terms of rejecting it so that everyone knows what's coming and that there is this counter argument starting to be made against the overwhelming din in the media by these pro-pipeline forces arguing in favor of the pipeline. Now we have a countervailing argument being presented by the President of the United States. That, to me, is significant, and I really hope that he continues on this track and ends up rejecting the pipeline because I just don't think that it's worth it at this point. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that the oil by rail that we talked about on that previous episode, which has become a bigger thing, that was an argument being made that, oh, well, and I probably made this argument too sometimes, oh, well, now that there's oil being shipped by rail anyway from these sites in Canada, the pollution's going to happen regardless. That argument now a little bit less credible after a small Canadian town was completely obliterated when an oil train exploded and just leveled the entire town, killed a lot of people, very sudden, very unexpected. I don't think they've quite figured out the cause. That is going to raise a lot of question marks in people's minds, and maybe the oil by rail is going to have to take a little bit of a breather and step back a bit from the direction that it was on. So this pipeline really does become vital to exploiting those oil resources in these tar sands reserves in Alberta, and the pollution is going to be raised significantly by building this pipeline. We'll wrap up the episode here. Persephone, thank you so much, as always, for joining us here on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for July 28th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every week, usually on Sundays, and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in Delaware, or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my co-host Persephone. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.